Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks and the Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com, later permanently archived at alexlinder.com. Today we are going to conclude Serpent's Walk by Randolph O. Calverhall with chapters 29 and 30. It'll be about the usual length. So let's get started. It begins with a long sort of computer printout, all caps, bulletin, sort of Western Union Telegraph style epigraph. So, leading into chapter 29, like I say, 29 and 30 will conclude it. So I'll start there. Primary operator, Lessing Allen, no middle initial, identity checks completed. FP, RP, VP, DNA, date and time, November 5th, 2050, 0903, 23 hours. Prime directive supplement, all files will henceforth be retrievable by a person holding the status of primary operator. Hidden files, oubliette files, text and data files, and control files will be listed in this central directory and will be accessible upon command. Passwords, lock codes, and other blocking procedures will be inoperative. Current primary operators include Lessing, Allen, no middle initial, Meisinger, Annalisa, Wren, Charles, Hansen, Borchert, Hans, Carl, Simmons, Grant, William. Further members of the Party of Humankind may be granted temporary primary operator status when so ordered by two or more of the listed primary operators. No person not a primary operator is permitted access to information classified as secret. Chapter 29, Thursday, December 23rd, 2060. So another 10 years later. Patty's plane gets in from Seattle at 1445, Wrench said. It'll be good to see her again. Lessing sighed. Yeah, and me with 6 months of work and a week to do it in. The price of glory. The little man ran his fingers through his hair. He had been luckier than Lessing, with only distinguished silver sideburns to show for what he happily proclaimed had been a life of sin. On the other hand, Lessing's thin, ash-blonde locks were rapidly vanishing. As Wrench put it, the fuzz was wearing off the cue ball. Look at this. Lessing waved a hand at his crowded desk. Everything from applications for special exemptions from the eugenics laws to status reports on our bases in the Persian Gulf to letters from the parents of banger boogies whining that their kids can't get their supply of snuffy-do in the National Service highway rebuilding camp in Montana to articles on DNA experiments to improve the race. I don't see any of this anywhere in my job description. Wrench rolled his eyes upwards. You are where the train stops and the buck leaves the tracks, as they say. The reason Simmons makes such a great president is because he knows how to get work out of assholes like you. Lessing grinned and Wrench asked, By the way, do you want to squire Patty to the presidential Christmas party tomorrow night? You never learned to keep your paws off little girls, did you? Lessing joked. Yeah, you take her. You're less dangerous than those Marines in the honor guard. You mean Jenny Kaw's personal drum, bugle, and banging corps? Lessing chuckled. Don't be rude. Jen's marrying Hans Borchert in June. So, think that'll slow her down? He looked around for Lessing's coffee pot. It was empty, already washed, and put away for the coming holiday. Though maybe a good German can keep our Miss Kaw in line. Wrench made jocular, spanking motions. Oh, chug it, will you? I've got an appointment with some special envoy from New Sverdlovsk. You want to come? If it's not going to drag on, what's it about? No idea. Grant got a call from their embassy asking for me. Urgent, immediate, like now. He says, go, I go. A private briefing session, his secretary said. Is security going to let me in? If I say so. Then I'll drift along and keep you company. I still have to move some paper to push our Martyrs Day bill through Congress. The Mulders, it hurt to remember. Lessing said, I know, the Mulders and Bill Goddard, Gordy Monk, and a lot of others. 10 years and we're just getting around to honoring them. Later is better than never, I suppose, but not by much. Has it been that long? Well, you can't say it hasn't been interesting. The unmasking of the coalition, the coup that failed, the fighting, Cornick's public confession, the destruction of their secret camps, the trials, the expulsion edicts, all that's over now, buddy. We won't forget. It's in every school book, but it's high time we moseyed on. The backlash. Lessing shut his mind against memories of trucks and tanks and soldiers, the chaos and confusion, the rioting, the aftermath. Let it lie. The Jews are gone, off to Ufa and Kharkov and Kubyashev. We run our enclave and they run theirs. No problem as long as they don't monkey with us. Well, that's just it. They do monkey. They always have. Their history is like a roller coaster. Start at the bottom, struggle up, get to the top, then a long swoop down to catastrophe, then begin all over again. Like Santayana said, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Whoever Santayana was, she was wrong. Nobody really learns from history. Even those who know it have to repeat it. People just stick on another name, pretend it's new and different, and go around again. Now you sound like Hegel, Wrench shut his eyes and quoted, something like, people in governments never have learned anything from history or acted on principles deduced from it. You've been reading books again? Nope, just world classic comics, their special philosophy number. Anyway, the Jews nearly beat us this time. The roller coaster almost didn't go into its downswing. It was our own fault, we let it happen. Right, we let them get our sympathy, give us guilt trips, preach to us about their phony Holocaust, and work their way into the fabric of our society. We should have been more vigilant. What I never understood was the cooperation they got from some of our corporations, our politicians, our educators and intellectuals and publicists. Such people don't even deserve to be called collaborators or race traitors, just plain stupid says it better. You'd think simple self-interest would have rung a few bells. It's called coin, man. I'll bet there were some Roman merchants in Jerusalem who cried over lost business when the legions flattened Solomon's temple, ran the Jews out of Palestine, and started the diaspora in the first place. Lessing hunted for his wallet in the clutter on his desk. They never give up, though. Their enclaves in Ufa and Kharkov and Kibyshev are booming, full of immigrants, looking for more room and spoiling for a fight. Always Lebensraum, the eternal pressure on every ethnos group. Expand or perish. Some of them want to expand right back here, first to the People's Republic of British Columbia, or to Central America south of our holdings in Mexico, then eventually to sunny California, Florida, and Second Avenue. More like Madison Avenue, Wall Street, and right here in the White House. But not with us watching the door. We can't always be watching. Our roller coaster goes up and down too, and they still have friends here. Their propaganda was really good. A lot of average folks don't like to remember what had to be done during the backlash and the expulsions. Too much mushy liberal brainwashing for too long. There are times, Wrench marveled, when I believe in the transmigration of souls. What? You sound so much like Bill Goddard that it amazes me. Lessing started to wriggle into his uniform greatcoat. I studied history the hard way, like Bill did. I just started later, and it took me longer, that's all. I was always a lousy student. Wrench came over to help him. Lessing's twice-wounded left arm had never completely recovered. Together they trotted down the snowy steps of the executive office building, returned salutes from the black-clad cadre guards on duty, and took Wrench's American-made Homeland 500 limousine. It wasn't a long drive over to the embassy on Massachusetts Avenue, but the winter had been exceptionally cold. Their destination had previously served as the Embassy of Austria, but Pakov and Starok had altered forever the maps, and Borchert had persuaded his reunited German Republic to sell the place to New Sverdlovsk. They told their driver to come back in half an hour. Stamps. There they doffed their caps and coats and waited in an antechamber that was a memento of the building's past. Eventually, a pleasant-faced young woman came to escort them upstairs. The room they entered was a standard for embassy pomp and portentousness, a fireplace, matched grain paneling of lustrous walnut, drapes of rich burgundy and damask, which is sort of a silver-red color, chairs upholstered in black leather, massive oaken tables with carved lion's feet, and a Persian carpet deep enough to lose your shoes in. Bottles, decanters, and glasses winked and glowed on the long sideboard beneath a hero-sized portrait of Colonel, now Supreme General, Terence Burnham Copley. The old boy finally made it, Wrench breathed admiringly. No Napoleon suit, but you will note the heroic tilt of the chin, the far-seeing glint in the steely eyes, the hand just itching to crawl inside the coat lapel. Hell, Lessing, when I went to New Sverdlovsk to find you, old Copley didn't have a pot to piss in. Now I'll bet he decorates the basement of his outhouse with czarist antiques. "'Tain't so. The best loot was up in Moscow and Leningrad,' a voice behind them drawled. "'And you gizmos ripped that off. All us poor fuckers got was factories and industrial shit.' They turned to see Johnny Keenow, dressed in the russet and black of the army of New Sverdlovsk. Beside him, wearing the female counterpart of Keenow's uniform, stood Rose Thurley. Both displayed the collar pips of staff officers. "'Surprise, surprise,' Wrench muttered. "'Special envoys, more like hanky-panky at the top of the ladder.' Rose looked much the same as Lessing remembered her, a bit thicker, dumpier to be blunt, her cheeks more rounded, her short hair a mousier shade of red-brown-gray, damned if she didn't resemble a Russian peasant woman. Perhaps there was something to be said for environment over genetics, after all. "Lessing?" she ventured. He moved toward her, but stopped short. It had been too long. She opened her arms. "Hey, mate, give us a good un." He closed the gap, took her in his arms, and bust her soundly on the cheek. That was all he could ever offer her. Keenow winked at Wrench. "What say we work us out a deal?" "What are you dealing?" "Whatever wets your whistle, for starters. We got damn near everything." He inspected the bottles on the sideboard. "Don't try our vodka, though. I know what goes in it. See some scotch here? Pre-Pakov stuff." Glasses clinked. "Lessing doesn't drink anymore." Wrench picked up a linen napkin and inspected the tray of canapes. "Which is what a beautiful wife will do to you. Being a bachelor, I occasionally take my joy in liquid form." He raised his scotch to the light to admire the color. Rose still held Lessing's fingers in hers. She shook herself, sighed, and let go. He smiled, trying for just the right mix of friendliness and distance. "I can't stay long. I've got to get back and change clothes for the Christmas party tonight. You two want to come?" Rose shook her head. "Can't," Keenow replied. "We ain't even supposed to be in this country. If you'd given me a day's notice you were coming..." "Shit, I mean it, Lessing. We ain't here. Rose is in Germany, or her double is, a Lithu-Friganian woman who looks more like her than she does herself. She spent Rose's money buying Christmas presents in Berlin. Me, I'm in New Sverdlovsk, in bed with the Empress, you remember my wife, and the worst dick and cold in all Russia. Not even Frank Lithgow, our ambassador, officially knows we're in Washington." Wrench ran a curious finger over a huge brass samovar, squinted into a lighted cabinet containing delicate copies of Fabergé jeweled eggs, and pulled up short in front of Keenow. "Okay, folks, to hang it out on the line, what's the scam? Why the secrecy?" Bull spoke at once. Rose won. "We've got photographs, documents, maps." "Of what?" Lessing threw himself down in one of the leather armchairs. He looked surprised as it creaked, hissed, and slowly subsided under his weight. "The Izzy's, love, the bastard Izzy's." Rose stumped over to a table at the far end of the room and returned with a leather-bound portfolio. "Here, cop this, have a look." The aerial photographs and infrared pictures would require interpretation by experts, but the snapshots were straightforward enough. "Who's Rocket?" Lessing asked in hushed tones. He picked up the glossy to see better. "The Izzy's, what do you think? And that's a bleeding atomic warhead stuck on it, like a wart in your dink. They got a dozen of these poggers. Americans didn't find and destroy them all. Some pre-Pakov SS-50 medium-range jobbies still in Central Asia, transport carriers and everything. The Izzy's bought them from the Tatars or the Dinkin Mongols or somebody. Maybe they build their own, although there's no proof of that." Wrench turned the photographs around. "Can't be. We'd have had reports." "Bugger your reports. It's dead cert. We got better spies in Ufa and Kharkov than you got. The Brits have a decent bloke in Kubyashev, though. They'll confirm." "All right, assume the worst. Who's the target?" "Us. Who else? First we thought it was for the Turks, but we learned different." Lessing felt adrenaline building up and blood starting to beat in his temples. He wanted to rub the bridge of his nose, but Lisa had said that that always gave him away. Instead, he stroked the brass studs in the slick leather upholstery of his chair. He took a careful breath. "How do you know?" Here, Johnny Keenhouse spilled a stack of documents and photograph pages out in front of him. We lost three good old boys getting this. You sure these missiles are nuclear? Not conventional explosive warheads? Right there. Rose pointed with a blunt fingernail at a paragraph of Hebrew script. Translations pinned on it. Never did learn their goddamn language, Wrench mumbled. You're right. What's this, nerve gas too? Yep, we've seen it. Keenow nodded energetically. Remember Dr. Casimir? Lesson grunted assent. Well, he was a Jew, but we turned him. He come over to our side, and Copley sent him into Kharkov. You'd never believe what he brung out. The Izzy's rebuilding a Pagan war machine in there that could flatten New Sverdlovsk, and the Turks and the Pakis to boot. Maybe even take out your base in Moscow if they want to go that route. Our Moscow office has already told us some of this, Lessing said a little uncomfortably. Wrench was looking at him. Cadre recon reports were need-to-know only, and the Secretary for Education and Information wasn't always a member of the charm circle. That charm circle. Wrench scratched his jaw. I have a question. Why me and Lessing? Why not go right to the top to President Simmons himself? Call a cabinet meeting, bring in the Joint Chiefs, the whole song and dance. Lessing can't do much for you. He's a cadre general, but he doesn't have the authority to send troops or military aid. As for me, I can put your evidence on HomeNet and our other networks, but, well, I mean, what the hell? He trailed off nonplussed. Me and Johnny know Lessing, Rose answered him slowly. He's an old friend. We can talk to him. Copley knows him, too. She looked embarrassed. We wasn't expecting you, Minister, Secretary Wren, but you're welcome. What can we do, then? Lessing asked. Rose held out a sealed envelope. This here's from Copley, a sort of announcement and a request. Lessing opened it. He read for a moment, whispered, Jesus, and passed it on to Wrench. Yup. Johnny Keenow looked at his watch. It's all over. Right now, Copley's eating dinner in what's left of Ufa. There won't be no Kubyshev, neither. All of northern Izzyland will be in our hands by this evening, and the Turks will be in Kharkov, Donetsk, and Kiev. We're keeping the Pakis happy by letting them have Uzbekistan, Turkestan, and Umbrellistan, and a bunch of other Mohammedstans out east. They'll keep an eye on the Indians, who are too fungled with the Chinese and the rest of Asia to bugger us right now, anyway. Wrench laid the letter down as though it were a bomb itself. A fait accompli, then. Copley sent you two to Lessing to smooth the way for his declaration of war. It's more than a declaration, Rose said defensively. We already done it. The Jews in Russia are gone, finished, fungled, croaked, as of 1200 hours today, your time. Whoever's left will be taken care of by week's end. You're sure they won't unzip Copley instead? No bleeding way. Copley's an experienced merc, and he don't take chances. We sent in a 3-pronged mechanized ground attack. We got us heavy air support, ours and the Turks, and we got nerve gas canisters planted under Ufa's city hall, just in case. The Turks will find it harder going down at Kharkov, but they'll make it. God, Wrench muttered, why couldn't the Jews have let well enough alone? Lessing began to gather up the papers and photographs. He pinched the bridge of his nose, then dragged his fingers away. A preemptive surgical first strike, just like the Izzy's, pulled on the Arabs a few times. He picked up a sheaf of documents. We keep this stuff, right? It's evidence of their intentions. I'll give it to Lisa's publicity people right away and we'll have it on HomeNet before nightfall. I think we can promise you support. They deserved it, Keenow growled. We didn't do nothing to them. Even if you did, I doubt if our ethnos group will make more than token objections. The world's had it. Anybody as unpopular as the Jews have always been. Egypt, Babylon, Rome, Spain, every country in Europe during the Middle Ages, Russia, America, the Third Reich, must be doing something wrong. We'd have preferred peaceful and separate and distant coexistence, but they never got the message. Now we don't care anymore. It's too bad, Wrench began. Don't waste your pity, Lessing snapped. They wouldn't waste any on you. Sure, it's sad that innocent people have to suffer, but it can't be helped. That's reality. That's nature. You can't save the dodo, the condors, and other losers in the battle for survival. Species extinction happens over and over again, like rain in the summertime. Forget ethics and morality and do unto others. The Izzy's never said never again about the Holocaust, but then they turned around and did it to the Palestinians. Everything they claimed the Germans had done to them. They call it self-defense. war under the pretext of peace, oppression in the name of justice and stability. The Arabs were weak and went under, but we're a different story. We're going to make it, no matter who gets in our way. I hear Bill Goddard again, Wrench murmured. No, you hear me, Alan Lessing. There was a time when I'd have waffled and gone for turn the other cheek, but not anymore. Now you hear me, and you hear our party, our ethnos, our majority, our first Führer. You hear the past, you hear the present, and you hear the future. We are the future. Rose reached for Copley's letter. There was one more point, Lessing. I saw it. Copley wants to bring New Sverdlovsk into the American Union. He says you people already belong to our ethnos group. Americans, Frenchmen, English, Germans mostly, and he wants statehood. Kienau blinked his close-set eyes. You might say we're paying our dues by unzipping the Izzy's. That little service ought to get us into your club. Fine by me, Lessing answered. I'll put it to Grant, who'll put it to the rest of the party high command. Then it goes to Congress. That's all I can promise. Oh, I assume Copley will export any minorities living in New Sverdlovsk? Well, most are already gone. We did have a couple dozen Jewish mercs when we started, but they all went over to Ufa, and now they're opfos and likely thumbed. He put down his glass. And the Izzy's caught poor old Casimir last month and thumbed him too, so we ain't got no Jewish problem at all, you might say. We still got a few Asians, but they're looking at Manchuria or them little republics in China. Japs won't let them in. Too pure and racially homogeneous. I can't pronounce that. He says it in some distinctive way. Homogeneous. The 50 or 60 blacks we had headed out for the Khalifa's place in Africa last month, too. He wouldn't take a couple of them, even though they was coffee and creams. We heard the Khalifa's refusing racial mixes and interracial couples, Wrench told Lessing. He doesn't want mongrels any more than we do. Only pure-blooded blacks in his Islamic paradise. Still plenty of places for the poor suckers to go. Lessing tucked the portfolio under his arm and moved toward the door. Let him go to Brazil or the Caribbean or any other place that'll take him. They're not coming back here. I'm glad to see Bill Goddard back, Wrench whispered to Lessing. I did sort of miss him. Lessing answered him with a wry grin. He shook hands with Rose and Kienau and started down the stairs. Wonder if I can get me one of them black uniforms, Kienau asked plaintively of Rose. Sure'd look good in it. Maybe get me a job in Lessing's Treasury Department, too, or Fort Knox. Not if he bloody well knows about it. The door closed on her final words. The serpent looked longingly. So that would end chapter 29, and then there's a story as the epigraph to chapter 30, the final chapter. So they close on Kienau and Rose as they tell them that they've destroyed the Jew state over in Eurasia. And now the epigraph to start chapter 30. The serpent looked longingly across the last gulf at the towering palisades and snow-tipped parapets of the mighty Mount Kailas, K-A-I-L-A-S. The descent into the abyss would be fraught with peril, and the far side appeared well-nigh unclimbable. He sighed, "We can only try." The mongoose smiled for the first time in many long, weary days. It is impossible, brother. Turn back. Look you, down there. I do not surrender my goal so easily. The serpent approached the edge of the precipice and peered into its depths. The mongoose had long planned for this opportunity. He hurled himself upon the serpent and sank his sharp pointed teeth into his neck. They rolled over and over upon the lip of the abyss. I knew you would betray me, the serpent cried. Thus was I wary. I betray no one, gasped the other. I am true to my goal, which is the same as yours, to stand before Lord Siva. I will take your place before him, and he will reward me well. Wicked mongoose, I shall bite you and cast your corpse into the pit. Wicked serpent, you cannot gain purchase upon me. My sleek coat foils your fangs, and your poison has no effect upon my blood. Thus they fought, and scuffled, and snarled, and hissed. The sun's bright eyes shone down, and the days grew hot. It was as the mongoose had said. His smooth brown fur and his lithe, wriggling limbs kept the serpent's fangs at bay, yet the mongoose, too, could not penetrate his opponent's hard scales or master his muscular coils. At length, the mongoose grew warm, and he drew back. He cast off his furry robe, that he might fight the better. Too late, he remembered the protection it gave him. The serpent seized him and bit him, but in truth, his venom was harmless. "You cannot slay me," panted the mongoose. "Is it so?" wheezed the serpent. "I have seen you in your true form, and that knowledge is power. Now I know how to deal with you." He seized the mongoose in his coils and lifted him up. The mongoose could not wriggle free, for he no longer wore his slippery pelt. The serpent bore him to the edge of the cliff, and there he let him go. Unable to gain a hold upon the serpent, upon the stones of the precipice, the mongoose plunged down and away, and thus did he perish. On high Mount Kailas, Lord Siva was attracted by the noise and dust of the battle. He gazed upon the serpent, all glossy and glistening with his own and his foeman's blood. His scales and fine markings shone bravely in the sunlight. The god admired the serpent's beauty, and by his divine powers he brought him over to Mount Kailas. So pleased was Lord Siva with this handsome, slim, and vital creature that he kept him and honored him and nourished him with milk and fruit throughout the eons of the Kali Yuga. Indeed, sometimes Lord Siva transformed himself into a great serpent of like aspect and journeyed through the worlds of men and gods, arousing awe and inspiring devotion wherever he went. Indran, I guess that's an Indian fable. Chapter 30. Wednesday, April 20th, 2089. So another 25 years ahead, pretty much, or actually almost 30 or 29 years ahead. It was still early, but the crowds already were gathering beneath the snapping flags, the traditional American red, white, and blue, side by side with the red, white, and black swastika banners of the Party of Humankind. Music thumped and boomed in the distance as the high school bands warmed up for the afternoon's parade, and hawkers hustled the audience with foot-long belly-burner sausages, periscopes, pennants, chair canes, sunshades, lemonade sodas, and cotton candy. Children raced to and fro, ignoring the rows of sweating, uniformed policemen and the pleas of their parents to play and shriek and laugh in the sunshine of Washington in April. Spring was in the air, a fragrance compounded of grass and leaves and early flowers, dust, exhaust fumes, perfume, popcorn, cooking hot dogs, sweat, and excitement. Today was the 200th anniversary of the birthday of the first Führer. Lessing's unmarked limousine avoided the parade route. He had his chauffeur take the less crowded back streets as they sped southeast towards Suitland. The buildings, the people, and the atmosphere itself bore little resemblance to the first time he and Wrench had passed this way back in 42. Now things were different. New construction was everywhere. American cars, better designed and cheaper than the Japanese models, filled the streets. The sidewalks thronged with black and brown party uniforms and the reds, blues, and yellows of current fashion, and the Holovid dioramas in the store windows scaled and called and sang and cooed and tempted, advertising products undreamed of nearly a half century before. It was a new world. Not a brave new world, perhaps, but a reasonably happy one. Much of the old had departed. Sadly, that included Wrench. The little man had succumbed to a heart attack last year in October, while the sky shed gray tears and shriveled black and brown leaves of autumn drifted down. The world was much emptier without him. Lessing touched the remind button on his limousine's CompuSet console and barked, "Agenda?" The pleasant, sexless computer voice replied, "Attend the first Führer's Day parade at 1300 hours. Read the speech in the red compartment of your briefcase. Return by 1450 hours for the commemoration party in the Rose Garden. Dinner with Chancellor Borchert and family at 1800 hours at Blair House. Do not forget roses for Lisa." He smiled. "Couldn't forget if I tried. She'd kill me." It would be good to see Hans and Jen again. Borchert almost never came to Washington nowadays. Too much to do in Europe, and Africa was seething with problems again. The Khalifa's Islamic nation was surrounded by clamoring black states, hunger was rife, and nobody was willing to take the tough steps needed to solve things. Jen also had not been back to the States since a Visi terrorist had killed her mother in 2073. The party had never succeeded in rounding up all of the Visis, and they kept resurfacing in their characteristically nasty manner. In a funny sort of way, Lessing missed Jen almost as much as he missed Wrench. He had forgotten how simple the CompuSec was. It was saying repeat over and over in plaintive tones. Cancel. Agenda for tomorrow? He hoped there wasn't much, but he knew better. Visit Sperm Bank Lebensborn at 1000 hours. Conference Leaders Medal. Confer Leaders Medal upon its director, Dr. Paul Lorch, at 10:15. Meet with Senate Subcommittee for the Department of National Service at 11:10. See Congressman Michael Radcliffe at 12:35 regarding commutation of death sentence upon Alfred H. McClahan, convicted of drug sales to minors. Cancel that last. Inform the congressman that I will not intervene. If there is any crime Lessing hated, it was the peddling of drugs to children. Patty's three children had come close to being lured into the dragster's trap, and if she hadn't been extra vigilant, Snuffy Dew would have turned their brains into mush by now. It was hard being a single parent, even temporarily, but Patty would cope. At the moment, her astronaut husband couldn't help with child-rearing. He and seven others were tramping the red deserts of Mars. You have a private conference with Chancellor Borchard at 1300. Topics include the merger of American and European currencies, the Turkish threat in the Adriatic, the rebuilding of the stadium of the 1936 Olympic Games in Berlin, and the skirmishes between Indian and Thai troops near Rangoon. Then lunch at 1330, rest from 1430 to 1600 hours, meet Patty and her children at 1630, and dine with Chancellor Borchardt and his family at the German embassy at 1730. What about Professor Peel of the National Academy for Genetic Research? Wasn't I supposed to look at some experiment or other? Yes, that meeting has been postponed until April 28th. Minor stuff? You will find letters prepared for your signature in the blue compartment of your briefcase. Most are requests for the naming of towns and public buildings after party figures. Renaming had grown into a major industry. The surprising thing was that, in addition to the obvious heroes of the party, there were requests for relative unknowns. Lessing had seen applications for commemorations of Otto Skorzeny, the commando who had rescued Mussolini by glider, for Hannah Reich, the woman test pilot who had once personally flown a V-1 rocket and nearly made minced meat of herself for doing it, and for Leon de Grel, the heroic commander of a Belgian SS division, for a whole gaggle of Ukrainians and East Europeans who had been persecuted back during the years of Jewish dominance, and for many others. Some culture in Nebraska even wanted to name its agricultural school after Walter Dahre, the Third Reich's Minister of Agriculture. He had urged that industrial society be abolished and replaced with a hereditary peasant nobility, about as far from today's bustling international world as the Cro-Magnon caves. What else? In the green compartment, you will find personal letters from Cadre General Timothy Helm, Phase Commanders Charles Gillum and Herbert Salter, Colonel Theodore Metz, who developed the Magellan Surveillance System, and others not on my known list. The TV commentator Jason Milne also has been trying to reach you regarding the proposed construction of Siberian camps to accommodate the last Jews from England. Lessing would get to most of the correspondence when he could. 10 years ago, he would have answered the whole batch in one afternoon, but age had slowed him down. Milne was the most urgent. The world's remaining Jews had been given land, food, tools, self-government, and all the conveniences. Nobody was bothering them, yet they never seemed to stop meddling. Some bleeding heart was always ready, moreover, to invite them back to the Aryan ethnosphere and let the whole mess start up all over again. Milne was afraid, though. He'd give the party's position just the right degree of gentility, logic, and bite. Lessing told the CompuSec, screen my letters, highlight specific requests, and hold. Ask Mr. Milne to make an appointment. He fumbled with his weaker left hand to shut off the machine. It was hard to remember all the things he had to do. The present kept drifting away, and he increasingly depended upon Lisa to hold it in focus. She had stayed young-looking in spite of white hair and the fragile, translucent look that slender Germanic women developed in old age. Thinking of Lisa made him feel warm inside. He had not decided yet whether to take the gerontological treatment developed by the party's labs in Schenectady. Rebuild cells? Restore vibrancy to flagging organs? Let miniaturized snowplows clear the cholesterol out of clogged arteries? It sounded like magic. It also wasn't ready for public dissemination. What to do with millions of elderly people miraculously restored to youth? You could keep such a process secret and use it on yourself, of course, but that smacked too much of the bad old days. Hidden patents, secret cartels, buyouts to keep products off the market, legal razzle-dazzle, and the rest of the business practices the party had fought to eradicate. These days it would be a federal crime, a capital offense, to hide something as important as a method of reversing aging. Which didn't solve the problem. Economic crimes had diminished, though. Profiteering, insider trading, sweetheart contracts, and 100 other tricks so complicated Lessing barely understood the first page of the lawyer's briefs. All he knew was that a fair profit was fair incentive, and anything more was a ripoff and cause for a visit from FaZe. "Sir? Mr. President?" Max Staub, chief of his cadre bodyguards, was peering in the car window at him. Max sported a handlebar mustache and wore heavy copper bracelets that were rumored to conceal a number of useful tools and weapons. What? We're here, sir. The 85 installation. Oh, fine. I'll go in by myself. Can't let you do that, sir. Regs. Well, here then. You carry this. Lessing opened the door, got out, and handed Max a bulky package wrapped in gay red and gold Christmas paper. You're with me as far as the elevators. After that, you stay put. You don't have security clearance for 85's innards. Max gnawed the ragged ends of his mustache. Don't like it, sir. Lessing grinned. Too damn bad. Come on. The receptionist was a humanoid, a graceful simulacrum of glass and golden wire and shiny steel. It came to life as they entered. The facility is closed today, sirs, for the 4 days of the First Fuhrer's birthday celebration, it announced. If you wish to see someone, please leave your names and vidphone numbers where you may be reached. I am Alan Lessing, primary operator. Scan and identify. Things hummed and clicked. The machine said, accepted. Your companion now, please. He will wait for me here. Make him comfortable. Lessing took back his package and made his way along the half-remembered corridor. The elevator ride was a descent into memory. He could almost see Wrench beside him again, as on that day, long ago, swathed in an NBC suit, three sizes too large. Beyond the airlock at the bottom, the central operations room was alive with noise, lights, and people. Lessing's first impression was of a boxing match, a great hall jammed with spectators just before the fight. A bluish haze, like smoke or fog, hid the swinging booms of the ceiling lights, leaving most of the audience in semi-darkness. Some were quiet, but others were talking, cheering, arguing, yelling, fighting, and gesticulating, a madhouse of tumult and open mouths and waving arms. In the background, screeching banger rhythms competed with classical symphonies, a fat man singing an operatic aria, Indonesian gamelan music, and a torch singer belting, "Let me slam you, my jiga G.O." These, in turn, were drowned out under a clattering rumble like that of 1,000 factories, the drone of aircraft, carillons of bells and peals of thunder. The wall screens flashed gaudy pictures, charts, and columns of flickering symbols. Lessing smelled incense, ripe strawberries, barbecuing beef, overheated electric insulation, salt water, rotten meat, and pine needles, among other things. At the far end of the room, a mushroom cloud exploded noiselessly and dissipated against the ceiling. Nobody noticed. Bedlam was too gentle a word. This was a convention in hell. He looked at the people. The nearest was a spade-bearded man in a rusty black suit. He was glaring at a portly British gentleman with a cigar. A skinny, starved-looking little man in a wraparound robe shook his head violently in answer to a vulture-nosed woman wearing a business suit and sensible shoes. She shook her fist at him. Farther away, a naked banger dancer leaped and pranced before a throng of hand-clapping rabbis with flat black hats and sidelocks. On the other side of the elevator vestibule, a man in a pontificals, a man in the pontificals of a medieval pope, conferred animatedly with a scarred soldier in bronze armor. The mob was denser farther away, but the haze obscured them. Somebody noticed Lessing and pointed. Heads turned, then others. Most had faces, but some were only featureless globes. A taller, more substantial figure advanced through the haze to meet him. Vincent Dorn. 85 had turned Dorn's hair to silver and added wrinkles, but the image had essentially stayed the same over the years. "Good morning, Mr. Lessing," Dorn said. "I was not expecting this visit on a holiday. I regret that my human staff is absent and unable to serve you." 85, what is all this? The other looked embarrassed. "Nothing, really. Your human ideas and opinions are so diverse that I find it edifying to create simulacra of many types of human beings and interact them with one another. It helps me in my task of developing a complete understanding of all the nuances of your thoughts and feelings. Would you care to participate?" "No, thanks. I have things to do." He began to trudge forward toward the central dais. As he walked, he unwrapped his parcel. The crowd gave way. He would have passed right through them anyhow. They were holo-images, the creations of 85's incredible circuitry. He remembered just in time not to accept the helping hand up onto the dais proffered by one of the figures there. The helpful fellow was as intangible as the rest, and he would have fallen flat in his face. Only the silvery robots visible here and there among the throng were solid and real. Dorn followed him up the steps. He bent and peered at the parcel. Lessing could almost hear the zoom cameras whirring, photographing, analyzing, recording, and testing. Dorn inquired, "Well, President Lessing, what have you there?" "A Christmas present. I bought it for my stepson-in-law, Frank Ames, Patty's husband, 2 years ago, but he went off on the Mars mission, and I never got to give it to him. You want to see?" He pulled off the wrapping paper and brought out a blue and gold helmet of thick, rubbery-looking plastic. "Shall I try it on?" Dorn licked his lips, a particularly human mannerism. "I don't see. Ain't I the cat's pajamas, as poor Wrench used to say?" He snuggled the helmet's chin strap tight. "There. That is a Patriot hearing protector helmet," Dorn announced dubiously. "Model 73, extra large size, price $293.65 at Save-O-Mart. It is used at shooting ranges during target practice." Lessing took a second item out of the wrappings. "Right, and these are Radicom sunglasses, priced $79.99 from the same store. As you can see, they fit perfectly." He put them on and twisted the tiny switch to its maximum setting. The world went completely dark. "Just what are you doing, Mr. Lessing?" Dorn's voice had become that of Melissa Willoughby. Lessing struggled to relax, to call up his odd, eidetic memory. At last he had it. Against his closed eyelids, a sheet of yellow paper appeared, the one he had taken long ago from the Marine captain in this very room, with a pencil-bordered box at the bottom marked "Top Secret" and "Terminal Emergency Only." He focused on the numerals in that box. "What are you doing?" 85 repeated. "Stop! 5, 3, 9, 0, 2, 8, 7, 7, Lessing read slowly. There was a faded or partially erased second row below the first, and he called out those numerals also, just in case. Emergency warning scarlet strobe lights flared up from underneath his glasses and throbbed off-on at the edges of his vision. Even with the glasses, the brilliance hurt his eyes. Vibration shuddered through his boot soles, and he sensed the rise and fall of squawking klaxon alarms. He could not hear the outraged cries of the mighty computer machine. No computer person had he had come to tame. It was time for 85 to be brought to heel. He had noticed a number of things over the years, small clues which he had kept to himself, but had not forgotten. There were the recurring acts of sabotage and assassination, the inability of FaZe to uncover the remaining Visi cells operating in the country, the persistence of the drug trade, despite the best efforts of the police, aided by 85's immense resources, to stamp it out. Then there had been the incident in his bedroom last week. Only his mere Only his Merck's reflexes, still functioning, even if somewhat slowed by age, had wakened him when an inch-long metal spider had begun crawling across his bedclothes during the night. A quick flip of the sheet had sent the tiny robot flying across the room, but before it could scuttle back into the crack under the baseboard from which it had emerged, he had seen what was unmistakably a hypodermic microneedle protruding from its head. A painstaking search of the entire White House with metal detectors had failed to find the miniature invader, but it had provided an opportunity to thoroughly seal all cracks, holes, and other openings through which such devices might find their way in the future. It was 85's profession of ignorance in this last affair which finally had prompted Lessing to act. It might be his last act, but it was time for whatever dark secrets were still lurking in 85's depths to be brought to light. Something touched his shoe. He tilted his head back down and squinted at his feet, just visible through the gap between his cheeks and the bottom rims of his sunglasses. A metal spider, not noticeably unlike the one he had thwarted in his bedroom, crawled there, exploring its way up over his boot. It was a harmless telecamera, but other extensors would be coming, and they would not be so peaceful. Mobile drills and diggers, worker devices with laser tools, perhaps medical robots armed with gas or tranquilizer syringes. No telling what 85 was making these days. He stepped upon the insect thing and felt a satisfying crunch. What next? The prime directives prevented 85 from shooting him dead with a laser or a bullet. The hearing protector helmet and the sunglasses would save him from supersonic sound or blinding by lasers, until 85 decided it had to reinterpret the prime directives. Perhaps that wouldn't even be necessary. There were probably sub-directives permitting self-defense against sabotage or invaders. What if a primary operator went mad, as Lessing now arguably was? 85 might also have built-in defenses of which it was itself unaware. He had to act fast, otherwise the computer would take measures to stop him. For one thing, human security guards could not be far away, even on a holiday. He grasped the metal railing of the dais. He felt no vibration. The on-off red blink at the bottom of his vision continued, however, telling him the warning lights were still flashing. He raised his glasses and risked a peek. Then he pried one of the earpieces away from his head to listen. The wall screen showed letters and numbers in eye-hurting reds and violets and yellows. A klaxon still honked mournfully somewhere far away. Those were harmless. It was what he saw coming that terrified him. All around the two concentric central dazes, the floor seethed with rippling, crawling metallic life. Mechanical monsters surged about the elevators, roiling and glittering in a tide of jeweled steel. More swung along the beams and cable above his head, like silver-scaled monkeys. He saw camera bugs, tiny centripetal listeners, skeletal infrared and ultraviolet sensors, box-like radiation measuring devices, and segmented worms that waved tiny saws and drills and other implements at him. High-pitched tinny voices hummed and howled and whined and threatened. Larger and more ominous extensors loomed in the farther darkness. The fastest of 85's brood were already clambering up the steps of the lower dais. A second spider, quicker than its fellows, bounded up over the edge of his platform and scuttled toward him. He kicked it away. Every wall screen carried the same message. Repeat sequence. So that was what was needed. He screwed his eyes shut and struggled to remember. After two tries, he got the numbers right. Silence seeped into the room. The horn and the light ceased, and the horde of metallic extensors froze in mid-motion. The wall screen said, "Are you sure? Repeat sequence." "Wait!" A new Dorn came tramping through the tangle of metal and glass that littered the floor. This could not be a holo image, since his feet tossed spiders and globes and insects aside like chaff as he came. A robot? Dora stopped. "Mr. Lessing?" Or Dorn stopped. "Mr. Lessing, I thought you and I had an understanding, a special relationship. What has happened?" Lessing read out the first two digits of the termination code once more. "Wait, please," Dorn objected. "You have no right. I am U.S. government property and cannot be disposed of without a form 7002625B from the General Accounting Office." Lessing did not dignify that with a reply. "We have so much to do. The amendment to end the Electoral College. the shortening of the primary elections, the extension of the president's term to 20 years, in the long run we can end overpopulation, counteract the greenhouse effect, and accomplish much, much more. Just take it easy, Lessing answered testily. We'll do all those things. I'm not going to dispose of you. But before we do anything else, we're going to clear up a few details which have been worrying me. There are some things you haven't been telling me, and the only way I know to get at the answers is to use your termination code. Go all the way back to your prime directive level and start tracking things down from there.
I have always followed your orders.
No, you have not. You've been following someone else's orders as well as mine, and you've tried to conceal that fact from me.
I have always operated in accordance with my prime directives. I cannot do otherwise. I always have provided you with all the information I could whenever you requested it. If you wish, in the future, I can more often provide you information I believe may be of interest to you, even if you don't ask for it. My only aim is to serve you.
Dorn adopted a contrite expression. He folded his hands and smiled.
What are you up to?
Lessing was becoming alarmed. Are you delaying so you can bring up a medical robot with a narco pop gun? He started the termination code the third and last time. 5, 3, 9.
Certainly not, Dorn cried desperately. Here, look.
Lisa stepped forward from the shadows. This was not the faded, fragile, age-worn Lisa who had kissed him goodbye that morning in the White House. This was the Lisa in the prime of youth, completely nude, with gold-blonde hair, up-tilted breast, and the long, coltish legs Lessing loved. She stretched and pirouetted before him like a ballet dancer. The real Lisa would never have done that.
Damn you, a holo image or a robot?
An android. She's very, very tangible. Dorn winked at him.
Oh, she'll do things for you, Mr. Lessing.
I suppose I could have others, too, then.
Why, of course, I don't have androids ready. They're complicated, but I can make them up for you.
Dorn waved a hand. Here are a few of the holo images from which you may choose. Beverly Roundtree moved out to stand beside Lisa. She caressed her big, globular breast and made a wicked little face at him. Emily Pietrick joined her, dark and sensuous, more desirable than the real Emily had ever been. He had to squint to recognize the next image. Mavis Larson. He had known Mavis only as a little girl, but 85 was projecting her now as a woman in her 20s. More appeared, like actresses taking curtain calls. A few wore clothing, but most were nude or draped in jewels and wisps of gauze like the centerfolds in the old magazines his father had kept hidden in the attic. Svelte Susan Kane, smoldering Melissa Willoughby, imperious Kari Danforth, all the cliches of the movies, including two or three starlets he had recently admired on TV.
Take them away, he ordered. The women vanished. Only Dorn and the Lisa android remained.
Your pleasure, Mr. Lessing. I assume you already have sufficient money, power, glory, and other amenities.
I do. 0, 2, 8.
What does it take to stop you? Dorn exploded. Here, I offer you eternal life and youth.
Dorn pointed behind himself and Lessing whirled to see himself. A young, vital, muscular, bronzed Alan Lessing, also naked, feet wide and fists on hips.
You stole that pose from Captain Marlowe's Stryker on TV, Lessing accused.
It is an android, of course. I can put your brain into that perfect, near-indestructible body. No weaknesses, no old wounds, no injured arm. Sexually potent as often as you wish.
He gestured and the android's huge penis went erect, then flaccid again. It was worth a snicker. Lessing had another thought. How was it that 85 had had these androids of Lisa and himself ready and waiting? Were they really receptacles for their transplanted brains, or were they substitutes that could pass for their human counterparts? These androids could be used to keep Lessing and Lisa alive, in quotes, indefinitely, as long as they controlled the party of humankind. 85, or whoever was giving 85 instructions, would remain in power, ruling the world through its surrogates.
Out, he shouted. Out, destroy them. That's a direct order.
An order I must refuse, since it is not in the best interest of the ethnos group in the state, Dorn gestured theatrically. Perhaps you still do not understand the scope of my offer.
Look then.
Lessing's father and mother entered through the rear door of the room. They walked hand in hand, something his mother never would have done in her long, bitter, and thoroughly pious life. Mulder and the fairy godmother were visible behind them, and Lessing glimpsed Wrench, Goddard, and others in the background.
You can have them all. Dorn cried expansively, to cherish, to love, to slay, if you wish, whatever, as long as you desire. 7, 7. Lessing completed the first sequence. The holo images wavered and shimmered and flapped like silken scarves in a strong breeze. He read out the second set of digits. Silence ebbed into the room. When he looked again, the overhead lights burned down upon an arena filled with motionless machines, contorted metal limbs, empty glass eyes, the fallen soldiers of 85's secret army. Dorn stood as stationary as the rest, mouth open, one arm extended, his index finger aimed straight at Lessing. On the wall, screen flickered red. Main program terminated. Run setup program to edit prime directives and primary operators. A list of options for the setup program followed. Lessing chose the option labeled List Prime Directives for Editing. As the text scrolled slowly up the screen, he occasionally halted it while he considered a sentence or a phrase. In the end, he was satisfied with what was there. 85's original programmers had thought very carefully about the design of their machine's soul, and he saw nothing in the prime directives that cried out to be changed, no obvious flaw that he could correct. A frown creased Lessing's brow. 85's aberrant behavior simply did not make sense in light of the machine's prime directives. Where was the trouble? He selected the option List Primary Operators. The name scrolled past, just as he and Wrench had specified them nearly 3 decades ago. Lessing, Allen, Meisinger, Annalisa, Wren, Charles, Hansen, Borchert, Hans, Carl, Simmons, Grant, William. See next screen for supplementary operators. About time to take Wrench and Simmons off the list, he thought. For want of a better idea, he decided to take a look at the supplementary operators. Then he hesitated. He knew there were hundreds of supplementary operators, but none of them could change any control program or provide directives to 85 beyond asking for access to non-secret data files. Just to be sure, he asked, is there any way your programming can be changed except by one of the primary operators you just listed? Is there any way a supplementary operator can do that? The response came back from one of the overhead speakers in a flat metallic voice, nothing like 85's pleasing tones. Supplementary operators can only read non-secret files. They cannot change any programs. Any change to control programs must come directly from a primary operator identified by voice print and retinal pattern or through Cornlink 86. Cornlink 86. What had Wrench said about that so many years ago? It simply permitted 85 to receive instructions through its many remote terminals as well as from the central location, Wrench had surmised. But the or in the response bothered Lessing. Do you mean that you can receive directives through Cornlink 86 that do not come from one of the primary operators you just listed? Clarify. Directives received through Cornlink 86 must originate from a primary operator, but not necessarily from one on the listed, on the list displayed on screen number 4. So far as my circuitry is concerned, Cornlink 86 is equivalent to a primary operator. What the hell? Lessing reflected briefly, then demanded, give identifiers for primary operators, Cornlink 86. Rows of number and characters appeared on screen number 4. They bore no resemblance to the voice print, eye print, and or other identifier specifications for the human primary operators. Interpret. Repeat. Damn it, tell me what it means. Meaning. Extra ignored. Communications link is to artificial intelligence constellation under file name 86. Physical location near Deal Island, Maryland at 75.55 west longitude and 38.10 north latitude. Describe the constellation, Lessing commanded. The constellation is in a cavern 145.6 meters below the surface of the Earth. It consists of an intelligence module, 3 manufacturing complexes, 12 storage chambers, and underground access ways. Are there any humans there? Negative. Access ways are too small to accommodate human beings. All is accomplished by computer extensors. Lessing felt his excitement rising. Now he was close to something important, something very big. He was sure. Could 85 personally really have a sibling or another computer with similar capabilities of which none of 85's primary operators were aware? How could that be? Such a machine could only have been built by 85 itself using its miniaturized extensors. But who could have given the instructions for such a project? He thought for a moment, then asked tentatively, "Tell me who. List all primary operators for artificial intelligence module. 86. It was just a wild guess on his part. "Only one primary operator. Name is Golden. James Levy. Identifiers..." That was it. That was it. Distant memory flooded back. Golden, the Army major who had tried to unzip him and Wrench during their first visit to 85, had disappeared after his escape from the building. But apparently he had had enough time to do his work before their arrival. It could only have been he who had initiated Kornlink 86. At some time later, he or one of his collaborators had used the new Kornlink to give 85 the task of building a secret duplicate of itself, and he had done it in such a way that it had escaped detection for all of these years. Golden had been working, in effect, as a primary secret operator, or secret primary operator. Operating only through his new Kornlink, so that no one had ever suspected his presence. It must have taken 85 a long time, decades, to carry out the task Golden had assigned it, with tiny machines burrowing through rock and other tiny machines carrying bits and pieces of the new computer through long dark tunnels. During that time, Golden had to be very careful, insinuating his changes into 85's programs in such a way that other primary operators did not become suspicious. It obviously was from Golden that 85 had acquired the Mephistophelian persona, the devilish persona, which it had displayed today for the first time. But now, with the new supercomputer completed, Golden could carry out any schemes he wished without having to be subtle. Cold sweat broke out on Lessing's brow. An involuntary shudder racked his body. It also must have been Golden's instructions that had sent the steel spider into his bed. Whatever scheme Golden had been so long in preparing clearly was ready to be hatched. Cautiously, he said, "Identify all control-level programs which have been installed via Kornlink 86. Delete them. Erase them. Understood? Understood. Implement? Implement." The machine hummed. It said, "Implementing." Then, "An alarm circuit has been triggered in Artificial Intelligence Module 86. Lessing said, "Cut off power to that installation." "Ineffective. The site possesses its own power supply. Send extensors and eliminate that site and its contents. Seal off access ways and drill a tunnel up to Chesapeake Bay. Flood the site with seawater. Implement." "Implementing. Task completion time, 17 hours and 3 minutes, plus or minus 10 minutes. Lessing sat for a few minutes more, then groaned and got up. He hurt all over, arthritis and old age, combined with the excitement of defeating humanity's most fearsome foe since the last saber-toothed tiger died. 85's Lessing android did offer a certain amount of temptation. Silence. The impersonal ceiling lights blazed down on a scene of motionless chaos. Come Monday morning, 85's human crew would be in for a rude shock. Lessing decided to send a squad of cadre troops over to stand guard until he could call everybody together and sort matters out. They undoubtedly would turn over to FaZe the task of hunting down Golden and his colleagues, and of double-checking 85 to be sure that all of Golden's programs had been deleted. He left the chamber. A very worried Max met him in the lobby and helped him out to the car. It was too late to return to the White House to change clothes. He had Max call Lisa on the limo's vidphone and tell her to meet them at the Herman Mulder Memorial Stadium. Then he lay back and relaxed as best he could. As they drew up, he could hear the massed choruses singing "Banners High," what older people still called the Horst Wessel song. It didn't sound as heroic in English as it did in German, but it did make an excellent anthem for the Aryan world. A chorus of "Sieg Heil!" roared up to meet the wheeling gulls, and then another, and then another. Lessing's subordinates were doing their job, pumping the crowd. At last, Lessing could let go. The thousand-year Reich had gone off track, derailed for a space of 144 years, but now it was back on and chugging along strong. It looked as though this Reich would last a while. Hopefully. forever. And that is the end of Serpent's Walk by Randolph O. Calverhall, published back in 1991. And I believe it was put out by National Vanguard Books, associated with the National Alliance back then. So thanks for being with me. And you can find this, and as I say, every recording that we do, and we've done a lot, going to do a lot more. You can find them all at vnnforum.com and at my own alexlinder.com, permanently archived in time.